insecure by default, which is about user experience insecurities, like having safe, secure defaults and enabling users to self-service through that. And there is no point in making software if it's not to enable people to do their things, to perform their tasks, and to do what they need to be done, or to ask for things. But if you do that right, you can achieve almost anything with a good UX. I have an example here. Disclaimer, this is not a Netflix example, which is like how we apply right-size privilege principle through our things in our security org. And that's something we've learned with time and with our product. Okay.
Hello, and welcome to the Modern Security Podcast. So today we're going to have a great discussion on usable security. But quickly, to take a quick step back, some of the biggest trends I see across modern security programs are security teams moving from breaking, like finding issues, to building, changing from being the department of no to helping enable their engineering counterparts to ship code quickly and securely, and a shift from finding one-off bugs to eliminating bug classes by embracing secure defaults, or as some call it, paved road. Well, I'm thrilled to be chatting with Letty Lorenzo, who works at Netflix, which to my knowledge coined or at least popularized the term paved road, which is pretty rad. So Letty, welcome.
Hi, hello, hi Clan, hi everyone who's listening. I'm Letty. My name is Leticia Lorenzo, but I go by Letty. It's just easier that way. And I'm an engineer, like Lynn said. I'm an engineer at Netflix for the past 3+ years. I'm on my 4th. And I stepped into security as a traditional product engineering, just like full stack, a Jackie of all trades kind of a thing. And I have a really strong background in UX. I have worked as a UX person a lot in different industries. So I am a computer science grad, but I consider myself a designer too. So I see myself with a combination. And I work right in the intersection of design and software engineering. So I've seen things, I've been around.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's so cool about this to me is that I think broadly we see this, you know, shift of security teams being more engineering focused, and obviously product teams have had product owners and designers for a long time, but the idea of having a security team with a UX and design focused person or people, I think is very cool. And yeah, we're gonna go deeply into what all that means. But before we do, I asked you right before this if your background was real and wasn't an image, and you shared some details that made me laugh. Do you mind sharing?
Of course. So I have this background here, which is like a lamp and some books in the cabinet and some art on the walls. So I photoshopped this background, and I went on the website of every single one of these things, and I picked every single one of these products put together in a fake background and used for about 2 weeks to collect user feedback from my coworkers. And once everyone thumbs up that it was a great user experience for them to see me on this background, I went ahead and I purchased all these things and made it in real life. So as you can see, I think UX through everything in my life.
Yeah, I don't know, something amuses me so much about you being like, what is going to be a beautiful background? I know, I'm going to test it. And then doing like, you know, the lightweight shipping quickly thing of photoshopping something together and getting feedback. Yeah, I like that a lot. And
you want to make sure you want to make sure you're building the right thing.
Yeah, totally. Without, you know, spending a lot of time buying the things and money. Yeah, makes perfect sense to me. Okay, so today we're going to deep dive into building a cross-functional security team composed of both security experts and developers, applying product principles to building security tooling, security-flavored user experience strategies, and a number of specific examples. We'll talk about the end-to-end user experience design process, and finally, some common mistakes and advice. So our hope is that by the end of this discussion, you'll have some solid principles and frameworks for thinking about usable security, a step-by-step plan for testing and then rolling out new security tooling in your org in a way that reduces risk and doesn't cause people a lot of friction, and a number of concrete examples you can learn and borrow from. So yeah, I'm very excited. Let's get into it. So, I think first, you mentioned this a little bit, but could you tell me more about the like structure or organization or who's on the Netflix security team that you're a part of?
Yeah, so I joined a team that's called User Focused Security Engineering, and I think that was very new to me. I never seen that kind of team inside of a security org. And some of the people on that team have also been some of the first traditional background software engineers that were being hired that were not necessarily security subject matter experts. I'll say SMEs because that's a mouthful, but they weren't security SMEs, security people, security humans. And eventually we became, but we can go into that a little bit later. But so right now I work in workforce and infrastructure security. We call it WISE, like a wise owl as our acronym. And we're responsible for securing Netflix corporate and engineering. So not only vulnerabilities in applications and that type of thing, but we also combine all kinds of things that are related to the workforce too. So we have a pretty hybrid team. So we have hired people that are security SMEs, of course, but we also have a healthy amount of software engineers, and we kind of work together that way.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've heard of a number of companies recently talking about hiring SWEs or engineers onto their application security or product security team, which makes a lot of sense. Maybe the security SMEs have some ideas on here's how we can maybe scalably reduce risk, but then having people who are like professional, high quality software developers who can help build the robust, reliable, scalable systems to execute on those things. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, can you or do you have any context around sort of the origin of how that started, or maybe like the early days, or I'm curious if just anything in general about like lessons learned, because I for other companies who might be wanting to do like a similar transition or like bringing on this new persona into the security teams, yeah, I'm just curious if there's any lessons learned, potential frictions, or how to do this in a very effective way that other people could maybe learn from.
Yeah, I think we started to hire more people that are software engineers out of need and the need of scalable, user-friendly, reliable products. But then our security engineers also started to learn these things and we all leveled up together in that way. But I think we, for example, our identity team has historically always had software engineering, like traditional software engineering, just because you're dealing with workflows that are super high touch for the users as an identity team, right? So they're probably the first ones to have traditional builders because they have a tangible product that you need to build that users interact with as identity. But for all the other parts of security, we started to introduce that when we were creating products that were bigger. And I think my team that I came in, user focused, it showed up when we were doing the Stetoscope extension. It wasn't an extension back then, but it's an endpoint management service. And every single person that works for Netflix would be interacting with it. And then we kind of needed to make it nice because it would be blocking or enabling people to do their work. So out of the need, we started to have more and more people. And I think it's on the profile, right? It's still the security people that do all of what problems we're gonna solve and think about risk a lot and create all these policies and controls. And then together with the software engineers, we build the platforms for this in a way that will survive, that it can scale, that users are gonna like and use that because we have that, I don't know, that background of knowing how to roll things out and get adoption. So combining those two skills have been a really interesting journey to be on.
Yeah, that makes sense. And definitely with Stethoscope, which is going to be impacting potentially every employee and making them either more or less effective, that's quite the responsibility, I guess, of the team to do good, usable work there. And I was just thinking, I think you're going to probably talk about this more in a second, but similarly how product teams are trying to design products in a way that gets more user adoption and more engagement and like that initial friction is lower. Like similarly with security things, whether that's trying to get more teams threat modeling or using security tooling or libraries, like it's really the same thing in some respects. I don't know. I guess my maybe meta observation is that historically security has often been like, you know, oh, I'm the special snowflake. I'm totally different than like other domains. But ultimately it's like, well, actually a lot of it's the same. You're still trying to convince other people to use a thing and spread adoption and things like that. So you'll go into more of that soon, but I don't know, that stuck out to me from what you were saying.
Absolutely, yeah. And I also think that it's all about patterns. We don't need to be rebuilding the wheel as security. Like there's other industries that have been doing the exact same thing, just in another domain and with different flavors, but we can borrow, and that's gonna be, we're gonna get into a lot of that, how to borrow things from wheels that already exist and put it on our own bike.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, before we get into that, could you tell us a little bit about user experience in general? And then from there, we can then focus into user experience within a security context.
Oh yeah, of course. So user experience, it's a passion of mine. It's a piece of work that it's an avenue of work that I've always leaned towards. And as a designer, also as an engineer, and everything is about how people consume. There's no point in making software if it's not to enable people to do their things, to perform their tasks, and to do what they need to be done with, or to ask for things. But if you do that right, you can achieve almost anything with a good UX. And for us in security, I think it's just coming from the place of understanding that users do not see or care about security and risk and those things in the exact same way that we do. They will not get out of their comfort zone to do something, to take a longer path just because it's more secure. That's a concern that we as security people have, our users don't. And we should be making as easy as possible for the shortest path, for the most desired path to do something is the most secure one. It's called secure by default, which is all about like user experience insecurity is all about that for us, like having safe, secure defaults and enabling users to self-service through that too.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing I've seen is, so maybe like the lowest layer is you're adding a more secure version, but perhaps it's higher friction. And then the layer better on top of that is, okay, we've made this secure way that's even easier than sort of the less secure way. So like, oh yeah, we'll do that. And then I feel like there's almost a layer above that where it's not just easier and more secure. It also provides additional maybe engineering value or user value, like, oh, cool, I get like logging and telemetry in addition to, I don't know, mutual TLS or some like security thing that that security teams would want, but engineers may have less sort of pressing on their mind. So yeah, I like that a lot. Let's see, so do you want to delve into more like the security focus or any general product principles? Yeah, wherever you'd like to take this next.
Oh yeah, of course. I think we can talk about product principles. And okay, so when we're talking about that, it's what are some of the values that we hold that we want to make sure that our product, like what kind of promises are we making to our users and what kind of things that we want to enable? And for us, a couple, like, I don't know, three things that are top of mind. We want to be user focused. What that means that we balance the impact of security controls and adoption and what we want them to do with their productivity. So their productivity, their experience, and the amount of disruption that our consumers are facing, they're also, they enter the math of, is it worth it? Because we really don't want to be introducing friction where it doesn't need to be, and productivity and the buy-in of users and them liking to be around us and interacting with us is also something very important in gaining their trust and being able to have the responses we need from them. So that's user focus. We do think about them a lot, and it's not just about me, Snowflake security, and what I want from you. It's that collaboration piece. A second thing that we think a lot is like secure by default, like I said before. So creating solutions that are central, that we manage the risk as we're creating it versus just remediating after. So preventative care, if you will. And we can talk about some more ways of doing that soon in some examples that we're going to dive into. But basically that, like enabling self-service, but also auto right-sizing things for the user of them and recommending good practices from the get-go. And then a third one is like actionable and opinionated guidance, which is like following up for the first. When we're from the second point, which when we're telling the user what to do or we're announcing something to them, we want it to be actionable and opinionated and that the users know what to do with that information. And that is like the biggest challenge because we speak security, the users speak whatever language they speak, probably English, but we're trying to say that something is actionable. And how to do that, you need to tell what is the priority, when does it need to be done by, how to achieve that, how long it's going to take for you, how much it's going to disrupt you, and having that perfect formula of what to tell people to do something, it's really, really helpful for them. So these three things, like user focus, secure by default, actionable and opinionated guidance, have been on our minds a lot as our main things we want our products to have.
Nice. I like those a lot. One thing I was curious about, the first one, user focus. So you mentioned balancing the security control or risk mitigation with the impact on productivity or other things. Just to like maybe get a little bit more tactical or specific about that, I'm curious how you think through like weighing those two off. Maybe, I don't know if you can create some hypothetical examples or even maybe real examples, because I'm thinking sometimes you might say, well, this is like a meaningful security risk. We want it to go down. There is a very quick and easy way we can do this, which is going to make the risk go down, but it is going to cause maybe low to medium level of friction. Whereas we could build something that is very low friction and great, but it's going to take us like a quarter. And so I guess there's like a couple of knobs here. It's like, how much risk are we mitigating either to the business or like from like individual people or individual products? And then how much friction is it? Like who's affected, like either by team or how many? And then how much friction is it? Is it like a lot? Is it a little? Like, is it making them spend 8 hours per day doing this like terrible thing? So yeah, I'm just curious how you think maybe in more detail about like the sliding scale of risk mitigated versus how many people are affected and how much and like how much friction. So I think we like broadly agree, but I'm curious if there's any maybe like nuance there you can share.
Oh, I feel like if I had an answer for that, I would be writing books about it because it's a very universal problem. Like it's a very like fine tuning, right? It's like, okay, if we make this thing super restrictive, for example, creating documents around the company, if we make it restrictive in a way that you need approval from a team to be able to share a document externally, for example, if I'm making a podcast with you and I have an outline of the podcast and I want to share with you, if I need to talk to somebody to approve that and make that like a manual process, right? That would be very secure. But if we create thousands and thousands and thousands, if I'm a lawyer and all I do is create documents and I had to do that so many times a day, that would cost X amount of business hours versus X amount of risk that we would be mitigating if we could simply just tell you when to don't share it externally if it's not for this reason and just give a meaningful recommendation at the moment of sharing. That would cost less for us to maintain. The risk would lean a little bit more into risk for sure, because it would give people the freedom to potentially make a mistake. But what are the odds of that happening and balancing that? So considering those things, and if users want to do something, like if I'm a lawyer and I want an external file and I don't want to be bothered because the process is too annoying, I'll just use my personal account. So you don't want to, users will find a shorter path not to be interrupted. So if you are not that, if you're not creating services for that, the risk will show up through some other avenue.
Yeah, hopefully a lawyer would be sharing documents illicitly, but yeah, like other.
Disclaimer, this is not a Netflix example. This is a random example.
Yeah, totally. One random idea I had as you were describing it, one thing that I think is somewhat unique and interesting about Netflix security is there seems to be a big investment in measuring risk, so specifically FAIR and other things where you're, to my knowledge, I'm not an expert in this, but I believe the general idea is quantifying risk in like specific dollar amounts. So it's like, okay, we have this risk here. We think that the likelihood of a breach or some type of thing happening is like this amount. And we think that if it does happen, it's like this dollar amount. So you sort of basically put a dollar amount on risk, which obviously like is not easy. It takes a lot of work, a lot of expertise. But I think it's like a cool idea. So I was almost wondering, like, if you have FAIR, so like, let's say you're like quantifying all of your risks in dollar amounts, and then you also have some mitigating security control, which is potentially causing people to do extra time. So let's say for the lawyer sharing documents, they share this number of documents per day or per week. We know that their salary is around this amount. And so like, let's say they do it, you know, once a week, it takes them an extra 10 minutes. This is their salary. So you could actually calculate, like, this is the dollar amount impact to the business of implementing the security control. And you could almost maybe compare that with FAIR to be like, you know, that we estimate the risk at 10 million, but we're costing 20 million employee time. Like, have you ever done that? I'm just like spitballing here.
I have not, and I should not. You don't want me managing risk. Though our risk team that spends so much time thinking about this, yes, they do that kind of math and they leverage, that's exactly what they do. They think about the experience for the user and how much it will cost for them to be doing these things. And because as a company, the money is the same. It's from the same pot. We save here and we spend here. It's the same pot. So there's always that on there. I don't know very well. What I do know very well is that there are very cheap ways of reducing risk simply through designing user experiences that will tell your users what to do in the time that they're doing. And then you don't need a whole robust system because you can use some simple rules of communication that other industries have mastered and we can tap into.
Yeah, so we should start getting into that. But so the product principle, so user focus, secure by default, actionable and opinionated guidance, generally great things. So yeah, let's delve into what does that mean within security.
Yeah. So I don't know. I you're gonna see on the outline label as security flavored user experience strategies and examples. Please, Clint, make sure
zested with security.
Please, and put an ice cream emoji there because it's a very weird flavor of ice cream. So for me as a designer, all we learn in school in design, we learn about patterns, and most of these patterns are applied in more traditional areas where design is very well invested. So in advertisement, in retail, billboards, concerts, you know, things that have been here for a really long time and have been designed for a lot and have some really strong patterns and formulas. But for security, there are some things, I don't know, if I think of like a really trusted, tested and true security pattern is the login, for example. The login, you know the login. If there is two boxes with a little thing underneath it and a button for you to click, it's probably your username, your password, and you click on it. And that's how login looks across the board. We're not gonna talk about MFA. And you know that that little thing on the bottom, it's probably, have you forgot your password? So even if there weren't any words on it, if I see a screen and a square and those things, I'll think login. So we do have in security some patterns that are very well established. But that's about it. It kind of ends at identity. And identity tends to be the place in security where things are more thought through. And just because it's where most people interact with security too, as an end user. But all the other spaces, I feel like we're paving roads a lot because there isn't a lot of tested and truth patterns. And that's what I spend my days thinking about, is how to borrow those patterns from other things that are very analog, like some problem areas that are analog to those, and apply them together. And all of this starts with information architecture, which is like design concept. It's a UX concept. You know what that is, Glenn? Have you heard of it?
I had heard of information architecture, but I didn't really know what it meant. So when you brought it up, I was like, please explain.
Oh, yeah. So it is a study as old as www. So where we basically think through, how do we show information on the web? And of course, now it's been evolved, so it's on screens, like whatever screens, how do we show information in them? And it's composed of a bunch of things. I'll give like a couple examples, and I'll plug in an article for the listeners to read, because it has somebody who has a PhD wrote this, and it's not me. So in short, what that says is a couple elements, and I will give some examples of them. So first one, organizational structure. So, you know, when I was talking about the login flow, right, there is a box and a button. And when you see those in the center of the page, you usually think of a login. So it's how we make sense of the content. It's how you connect these different pieces of information together. So for me, an example, top of mind, let's say we're going through this login, and the moment that in the screen, it shows you who you are, like it says your name for you, you know that you're logged in automatically, like if you see your data on a page. And then if I want to say a weird name, like funny carrot 123, and I put that on the bottom of the page and your login information is on the top of the page, that information doesn't mean anything. It will only mean something if it's next to your avatar, next to your name. So if it's like your email, funny carrot 123, you know that that's a randomly assigned username for you, kind of like Reddit does, right? So where this information is makes or breaks that information structure. So that is one concept, and like an example of a concept in, so proximity and how you show things. So that falls under organizational structure. Another one, for example, hierarchical structure. So it's how things flow down. So let's think of, okay, now we're logged in, we have a username, let's think of retail. So you're in a, you have a menu, it's probably on the left, and you're gonna, I don't know, usually choose fashion preference, and it's usually gendered. So you wanna boys, girls, women, men. So once you go through that menu, the next thing you're gonna see is what kind of thing do you want? Do you want clothes, accessories, shoes? And okay, let's say I want clothes, I'll go into that. And then tops, bottoms, jackets, dresses, pajamas. So you know to expect that architecture, the hierarchical aspect of it. And the study of that and how to do that, it's part of information architecture too. And then there's like sequential structures, which is how we help you to do something. And it's usually, it could be very overwhelming if those things were thrown around. So, okay, following up from we've logged in, we choose what we want to buy, and now we need to check out. Like, it would be really stressful if it was everything in one page. You would say what you want and then where to ship, how to pay. No, we usually do that in a sequential thing, right? You add an item to the cart. The cart does something on the top right, show something, and then when you click there, it starts the checkout process. You have a chance to update the amount of things that are there and adjust the things that are on the cart. And then only after that, you get to say, where do you want to ship? And then only after that, you get the payment information. So, and that is sequential structures, like a type of like a flavor of information security. And then same thing for like labeling, navigation, search, pagination, all those like building blocks of user experiences.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm thinking about the like retail or shopping example where yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense as a user where you're in different states. Like I feel like mentally I'm like, okay, cool, I am on this e-commerce site. I am searching for different things I want, adding them to some cart, and I'm in like, okay, I'm in shopping mode. And then once you click on your cart, then it's like, okay, cool. Now I'm in like logistics mode where I'm probably going to give you some sort of payment info, probably give you an address, and then I'm going to get some sort of like confirmation that it's been purchased and maybe like what time frame I'm going to get the items in. So yeah, there's a bunch of like sub steps, but at least as a user, simplistically, for me, there's sort of like two phases. So yeah, I could definitely see how that would help maybe whoever is remediating some sort of security issue to be like, if we could help them build this like mental scaffolding of like, you're in this phase, like you're maybe learning about your environment or risk, and then it's like, cool, now you're like fixing a few things or something. Like I you'll talk in a second probably in more detail, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I love that. It makes total sense. This thing that you said about the mode that you're in, and you know the contracts of those modes too. You know that when you're shopping and just putting things on your cart, I love that you said that you're measuring risk. Yes, you are. And you know at that point you have no commitments to anything. You can play as much as you want. You add, you remove, you do whatever, you navigate, you can leave at any point, and you know that this is playground time. I know that too well. And then after that, it's serious. Like the moment you start the checkout workflow, that's a different pattern, it has a different contract. You know that that one is a serious one, and you can't make mistakes as easily. And everything you need is designed to be a certain way, it's designed for you to purchase. And that's why the shipping is before the payment, because if the shipping was after the payment, sometimes it's just weird. Just how do I give you my money and don't tell you where to go? So the user has those strict expectations through every single pattern. And same thing for security things, as we're gonna learn.
Yeah, I like that. You emphasized the like how serious is like the thing I'm doing, and I like the idea. If we were to maybe reverse that to say, if the website like inverted that expectation, you could imagine like you're looking through a bunch of items, you're like randomly adding them to your cart, and then spontaneously it's like, "Yo, give me your credit card," and you're like, "What do you mean? I'm just like searching for items," or if like randomly adding an item to your cart like caused it to be bought without you like doing a separate step. Obviously like some sites have like the buy now button, but assuming it wasn't that. But yeah, I forget exactly the words you said, but something about like the relative importance or seriousness, or like is this like taking an action, like changing the state of the world type thing. I like that within security as well, like maybe like making that very clear, like yeah, just how like important is like the thing you're about to do. Like are you mostly just like learning and experimenting, or is it like, oh, this is going to potentially change the security posture of some system or affect prod or something like that. Like just making that like super clear all the way through. Okay, last thought. This is maybe like a little embarrassing to admit, but I wanted to share something that should have been obvious that I feel like I learned when you like were telling me about this stuff. So when you were talking about borrowing patterns from other industries, like billboards and like marketing and like all these things. I think it should have been obvious, but it wasn't to me. But when you step back and think like, what is the role of security teams? Ultimately, I think we are influence organizations, right? Like, yes, we build some things and we do sometimes fix some of the things ourselves, but generally we want someone who's not us to fix the thing because there's just many more engineers than security teams, right? So like when someone is doing the thing and you're not directly like their boss or their, you can't like force them to do a thing, like ultimately you are a, yeah, like an influence team trying to like convince people to do what you want and leading not necessarily with like top-down authority, but more like convincing. And if we think about say advertisements or billboards or things like that, like it's exactly the same thing, right? Like they don't control you and they can't force you to buy anything, but the whole thing is framed around convincing you to want to do a thing. Exactly. Like that's literally like advertising and marketing, that is definitionally what their business is. So if we think of marketing and advertising is trying to convince people without authority and security teams as similarly trying to influence out with without authority, why would we not take the principles, ideas, and things that they've spent, I don't know, probably $1 trillion learning and perfecting? Like we should steal from some of those things, at exactly. least what makes sense.
And exactly. And these tools, it's just about looking at them intentionally and breaking them down by intention, right? Like a billboard is telling a group of people in a specific location that something's going to happen versus an invite on your mail that is telling you, one person, what's going to happen. And they know, look at the delivery. One is like really big and in front of everyone and the one is like really small. And on your mail, you tend to respond and because it's personalized. Better than if you would in a billboard because it's for everyone, so I don't care. So we get to bank on those things. And like all of this like includes psychology and a lot of studies that they've paid to solve. We haven't, but we can use.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, I just wanted to thank you for teaching me something that I think is very important that should have been more obvious than it was to me until you shared. So yeah, thanks.
Of course. And then I can give you more nuggets on that.
Sure, yeah, feel free. Yeah, I'd love them.
Okay, so it's all about like exactly what we're talking about. Building mental models and patterns, right? Are you like users on the internet, online? It's just so much. There's so many things. And we have a finite amount of time, most of us, on the internet. Of things that we want to do and we can do and that we're willing to learn just because it takes so long. Like anytime a new super disruptive kind of social network shows up, I don't have stamina to relearn. Like, are you Facebook? Are you Twitter or Instagram? Which one of the three models are you? Can I post picture? Can I post text? Or can I just get gossip? Like, I don't have the bandwidth to learn anything. Don't come with, you know, forever scrolling through videos. It's another one. So everything is a copy of something in that way, because everything works in a patterny way that way in the web. And that works this way just because one, it works and people are used to it and you're not asking too much of them. And in security, all we do is asking people for things. And if we ask for them to do something that they don't want, disrupt their work that they don't want, and using a weird thing that they don't know, that's too much. If we can use a thing that they already know, they don't need to think about it, just don't make me think, we take one of these things out of the equation. So it's all about building and leaning into those patterns. So I have an example here, which is like how we apply right-sized privilege principle through our teams in our security org. And that's something we've learned with time and with our products. But basically, the users will only learn this process once, and then we can apply it to different domains, completely different domains. But it's like a system, a way of thinking that they have been educated on, and that's how it's going to be for any single thing that fits on it. And the model, for example, it starts with creation.
Sorry, quickly before you get into it, just to make sure people are on the right page. So by right sizing, you mean hey, currently things are overly permissive, and then you want to maybe make it more least privilege, like automatically for them without taking action.
Exactly. Basically using the least privilege principle of security, like don't have access to things you don't need, because that is risk that you don't want to carry. But how do we do that? Through different things. So yeah, exactly what I said. We call it auto-rightsizing. So there's a couple ways to do that, but like it starts with the creation. So that thing that we've talked about, when the user goes to first create a thing that's risky, we get to tell them in that place, here's our recommendation. This is risky. This is not risky. This is desired. This is risky. Like just tell them right there. And then just by doing that, we're removing the factor of just the, I didn't know, like the removing the uneducation of that, because we are communicating. And if we do that well, the users will understand what is the preferred path. Like a blue button and a red button, you know, you should pay attention when you click on the red button. So there's, you know, ways of doing that. And then starts by that. So when they create, they're already informed of the risk. And if they decide to proceed, they're carrying that risk. And then there's a couple things that we do. Using our detection system, we identify things that do have broader access than they need to have. So we communicate that to the user. So for example, an SSH policy that has it's very broad and it's very unused. We can, like, it's a good candidate to be auto right-sized, right? And if we detect that, so the way we do that, we could just do that on the background, but we choose to do that, schedule that, make a list, and send it to the owners with a brief explanation of what's gonna happen, that how we detected it, and that what will be happening. So we basically follow this thing that it's very, very used in marketing and some other places too, like completely outside of security, but like they have a perfect formula to communicate that, which is like the 5 W's, like what, when, how is not a W, what, when or how, and which thing and for who, and I don't know if I said when, so all of those things. So we basically tell, here's the list of assets that has too much access that you're not using. Here's an explanation why that's not a good thing. So that's your what. And following up on the what's going to happen is we're going to be shrinking down the access of those things. And then we give them some agency, like you can exempt, or you can choose not to, or you can give a good use case for this and prevent this from happening. And we just maintain an auditable list of these things that were touched by our system, so the users can always refer it back. So we have every single one of these W's and every single one of them auditable. So we are maintaining that kind of information. Users appreciate that because it gives them agency over their games, and they know when they get that email, next time they're about to create something, they will think twice, because security has touched my thing because it wasn't good. It was holding risk. So I'll try not to create risk next time, because security explained to me everything about it and why it's risky and the amount of work that took just to fix this too for other people. So yeah, that's like a example of a transferable mental model, because you can do that with SSH policies, and you can do that with, I don't know, Google Drive files, like with documents. You can do that with anything, that any type of entity that has access.
There are a bunch of things I like about that. Yeah, definitely the for as you just said, having like some security controller thing that is applying across a bunch of areas, like Google Drive and SSH, and the way it's communicated is like consistently the same, so people just need to learn it once. That's awesome. And then having both, I guess, asynchronous. So in the moment, the person's doing the thing, and you have like a almost like a clippy that's like, hey, did you know that this is risky? And here's like all the things. And then a asynchronous thing happening in the background where you're just polling the environment to say, hey, this seems to be overprivileged. And then I think the process you talked about is like letting people know before you do anything so they can change it if they want to. And then eventually like right-sizing it for them so they don't have to do anything. So again, you're saving people time while reducing risk, which is awesome. And then having the list, the audit list after to say, hey, here's the things we did. I thought that was very clever as well. So yeah, I like that. You mentioned Google Drive a little bit. Did you want to chat about it in more detail, if you'd like?
Oh yeah, of course. So we use this exact pattern. Like, I don't know, I started to be intentional of this pattern because of this project that I worked on, in which we were considering the risk that old files have, just files that haven't been accessed. And we created a program, like a whole product that manages that risk for us and helps us with all of that. And it's very interesting. It consists of every single one of these parts. So first, there is a just-in-time and just-in-place desired behavior recommendation, which is, I don't know, when you go to share a document internally, we have a Chrome extension that's in your browser to insert in the page a blurb saying, share with this audience if it's for this use case, with this other audience if it's for that use case, basically telling how we see that kind of risk and how what's the desired path. And it looks really fun. We change like a little bit of the Google page itself, like the share button. And I don't know, if a document's public, it looks a certain way. If the document, you know, we just use of communication tools to grab people's attention and tell them about that. So when you're creating, you already know what security thinks about this. So you're coming in from knowing something. So that piece of education. And then the next one, like risk detection, if our systems, we have some policies that people that manage that kind of risk comes up with. But if an example of a policy is like, oh, this document is really, really old. It's like from 2009 and hasn't been accessed in so long. So if our system picks up under this policy, these documents, they will want to auto right size them. So shrink it down to just the owner of that, shrink the access just to the owner. And because nobody's using that document, nobody's seeing that, so it doesn't need to be open. So we do that. And then in doing that, how it works, we send an announcement. So we send on their email, hey, you have this many files. Here's a list of these files. They have not been touched for the past 10 years. And we're going to shrink down access to just you because there's no audience for them. And then in the email, it follows that exact same format that tells you who, when, where, when, all the W's. And yes, there is an information on how to revert that. Like, oh, this document, it's not being accessed, but it's really important that it's to this audience because they might. So then you can ask for an exemption for that file and create exceptions. So, which also gives the user some agency over their things, but it does secure by default for them, for the users that don't care. And most of the time, people don't care if nobody has access because it's not important. And then after that happens, that scheduled right-sizing happens, we maintain an auditable list of everything that our system has touched the user so they can dig down through it, or like, oh, something happened, I used to have access to this, now I don't, you can see. So everything is auditable. And then another thing too that we noticed that was missing from this, it was, tell me when I have just created something that is hitting a policy. For example, I don't know, I created a document and I have exposed it to the internet. So we send you emails telling you, oh, you have done that. Was it intentional? After the fact. So just to have like that one more hit of this is passing against the policy, and just like letting them know that too. and giving them a chance to correct that before the system picks it up itself. So we attack it from all fronts, but with the, like, involving our end users in that, because it's their asset, they own it, it's their documents, their knowledge, and we're here to help, not to block, but we're gonna share with them in relevant points everything we know and think about.
Nice. Yeah, I like that process a lot. One thing that stuck out to me also about, you talked about the Chrome extension changing the visual appearance of the page. Okay, I'm going to go on my non-existent UX soapbox or pitch you. So they talk about, or a common expression is like when it's in a public forum or something like that, be like, don't say anything that you don't want to be on like a billboard in Times Square or on the as the headline on like the New York Times .com. So could you use the Chrome extension for public pages to change the top of it to be like a billboard in Times Square or like the headline of the New York Times? So then like when you're writing in it, you're like, oh, I should only have things in here that I don't mind being super public.
Oh my God, that would be great. I wish Twitter had that.
Yeah, totally. Although that might be so fun that it encourages people to do public documents. So maybe don't.
Yes. Good to know. Yes, that's a great idea. It gives you the sense of responsibility of what you're putting out there.
Yeah. Or, I don't know, a picture of your phone and like your mom or something on it being like, are you?
I know. Are you sure?
Are you sure?
Would you say that to your mom?
Yeah, I like this a lot. So another thing you mentioned previously when we were talking is creating an effective and reusable self-service pattern. So I was wondering if you could share a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so our self-service pattern, it's exactly those like five W's and how we do that more intentionally. Because yes, we can auto-right-size, and that's our our process, the one that I just talked about. But then there is also the cases in which we want to engage people. We need people's input. They need to perform a task. And to do that, you have to respect their time like it's gold, because we're asking so much of people already. And we can just follow some simple information architecture pattern for delivering a good message, which is those five W's we talked about. And then, so in the delivery, like, I don't know, if we're thinking about giving a guidance, so something like, please encrypt this thing. So we can say in the delivery, in the body of the message, we say, okay, this is the thing that we need you to fix, not just like fix all your things. It's like, no, it's targeted this one. Almost that same concept. If you put on a billboard, I don't care. But if you put it on my mail, it's for me. If it has my name on it, it's targeted. So really target the asset or the thing that you want them to fix and give them a timeline, because people do things when the clock's ticking and someone else learned all about it, and we can just borrow that. And then also tell them how hard or how disruptive it will be. For example, if we want them to, I don't know, update their OS on their computer, it will be really helpful if you tell them that you're going to have to restart. So you don't start when you're in the middle of your workday, in the middle of a meeting, and shut everything down. So if it's in the body of the message, like, okay, click this button to update your OS, it will restart your computer. It will take 30 minutes. Try to do this at 5 p.m. after work. People would really be appreciative of that, of like telling the disruption. And then give clear instructions of where and how, like what to do and where. So if we can like deep link through things, so people don't have to like be scrolling and looking for things, and just tell them where to go or give them exactly the path. And then also to who you deliver, that it's very important. So who are you telling to, I don't know, encrypt their disk on their computer? Hopefully the owner and not their manager, because their manager can't really perform that action. They can only nag them to do that. So know exactly who you were telling it to, and then give them a path to let you know how you're thinking about this. So think about it almost as Jira status, like Jira ticket status. So this is in progress. This I'm not going to do because of that reason. So to give them a way to tell you, because any exceptions and everything else, you also learn about how the users are thinking about this. And then every single one of those points are things that we can borrow, like some taxonomy that we can borrow from other places in the world that do guidance and that we can consider. Can you think of one? Like, just hearing this process, does something come to mind? This is not a quiz.
Oh no, I didn't study. Yeah, I mean, like tickets obviously came to mind in terms of like, you want to be as specific as possible, so it's as actionable as possible. I'd say maybe like an outside of tech, maybe like an invitation to some event, perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah, if you're going to go to a wedding, right? That's exactly the kind of thing. Like, you need to know who the hell's getting married to begin with. And then, like, I don't know, who is the invite extended to? Can I bring all my cousins? Or is just me and my immediate partner? Like, who do we bring to this wedding? And then where it is, what time it is, if there's any dress code, be helpful to know, and a pass to RSVP. So please go on this website and RSVP, or send a mail to this thing so we can account for the food later on or something. So I don't know, when you think of a wedding invitation, it has these same core elements as a security guide. Though security is way less fun than weddings, be advised.
Yeah, well, for now, we'll work on making the experience better. Cool, yeah, that makes sense. Did you want to mention anything about, I think, another sort of heading or topic, like just-in-time guidance?
Exactly. Just-in-time guidance is exactly that thing that we're talking about, Clint, how we tell you in Google Drive, while you're there about to share a document, we tell you what to do. We consider that just-in-time guidance because we're not asking you after the fact to go out of your way to do something somewhere. We are telling you the best way to do something in the place you're at. So if we were to like tell you about a vulnerability that you need to mitigate or that you need to get on top of, a package that you need to update, if that was on your code, as you were coding, that would be really helpful, right? Because it's just there versus on your email when you have, like, I don't know, you don't even have your machine open, and then you'll just, you know, it's just different. We can get more into that example too, because I have a lot of thoughts. But another one, following on just-in-time guidance, right? My process as a designer, thinking about this, it's, I look at patterns of interruption in other places too. So how, I don't know, if like if the government, I wrote out an example that I'm very proud of. If the government gives you a jury duty, I never been through that because I'm not American. If you're sensing an accent, I'm Brazilian, not American, and I don't do jury duty. But how does that notice look like? And I'm pretty sure that they score all the bases, and it's like it's asking you to do something out of your day, like that's not on your schedule. And same thing, like when a city announces a new development, like are they gonna come to your house, knock on your door and tell you about it? Are they gonna put a billboard? Are they gonna put it on TV? What kind of platform do they choose to do this thing on? And same thing for, like, for example, the fire department, and they have like an earthquake drill. Are they gonna set an Amber Alert for that? Are they gonna put it on your email or in your mail? I don't know. So a good use, like a good thought and way to think of just-in-time guidance is about how this city does things. And those are like patterns that most humans know. So how the city uses all those road signs to announce scheduled maintenance or something that's gonna happen. So they're gonna use like those digital signs and say, oh, on March 24, we're gonna redo this portion of the road and you're not gonna be able to access it. That's a delivery, right? So somebody who's passing there, they might or might not see it. And somebody who will be affected, somebody who will be commuting on March 24, might or might not see that. And then on the day of, on March 24, the thing's happening, the city usually puts a bunch of signs and they're usually orange. And there is a one that has an arrow that always tells you where to go instead. And when you see that one, you know that your preferred road's not going to be there. And as you're going through the road, there's like some lights flashing, some little sirens, some men at work sign, and you know that work's happening there. So when you see that, you are that commuter that is there on May 24, which is different than when they put it on the sign, because that might or might not be you. So is it hitting the right people? We don't know. It's just hitting people. And but that one in place just in time when a thing is happening, that one for sure 100% is on the right target. And as we think of that, I think of the biggest problem of my life as somebody who does application security too, is who owns this app? And just in time guidance really helps me think through that, because probably whoever has, I don't know, whoever is on the source code of that is probably somebody who has interest in the app, either own it or know somebody who doesn't, because all the people that are not, they're not going to be hanging out in source code for fun. So it's that same paradigm. I can just put a billboard telling that something's going to happen, or I can target in the place. And there is some challenges for it, because the way you build software, it's a lot easier to build a centralized place and maintain the information all in one place. It's just neat engineering to do that. But to be on all these different avenues, it can look very scattered. So how do we have a solid security experience that feels the same, but is spread in all the different places? That's what I dream about.
Yeah, I like that. Something that the communication is consistent. It feels very unified, even though it's going wherever the user is, whether that's in like wherever you're hosting code in your IDE or in Google Drive if you're doing that, or I guess in the CLI you talked about SSH right sizing previously. So yeah, I like that. You've given a bunch of principles and a bunch of like cool examples. I was wondering, just to maybe tie everything together, if you could maybe talk from start to finish about the user experience design process. So let's say people are listening and they're like, wow, this sounds awesome. I want to do this at my company. Maybe like yeah, what's the methodology like? What are the like, okay, do this, do this.
Yes, so traditional user experience design, or how most design industries work, it's usually ahead of production. So for us, the user experience planning and designing becomes one step like in the beginning of the software development life cycle, because you want to make sure you're going in the right direction before you start building anything. So we follow my team a pretty traditional process of we research, we test, we design, we make sure that this is the right thing to build, validate those approaches, and then we go ahead, hand it off to engineering and make it shiny and usable for everyone. So how that looks like in a schedule, if you will, like kind of in order. And sometimes there's like a difference in the order of these things, but usually we collaborate with whoever's the product manager or the informed captain, as we call, for that specific project. And that person is usually someone who the owner of that problem, the most interested party in solving that problem. So very often it's like security SMEs that are driving down risk for that thing. in specific. So we collaborate with them, we talk to them, we try to understand exactly what they want to achieve and what is feasible to build. And by the way, I'm a design engineer, so I do post-design engineering in the intersection, so I do think about the ways of building things, and I think about our systems too, and I just think that that helps me design, knowing the feasibility of things, knowing what we can, what we cannot build, what is too costly, and I don't know, have better ROI throughout the whole process. So have like a very solid kind of requirements for the product and feasibility. Then once we have a good document that everyone has picked apart and we're very confident about and passed through Grammarly, then we go into translating this into buildable solutions. So that is the fun. That to me is the best part of it all. It's when I open my favorite software, that is Figma, which is like a UI UX design software. I don't know if y'all have heard of it, but it's like really fun and everyone can use it.
Actually, a few times ago, I did interview Dev, who's a friend who's the head of security at Figma.
Yes, very nice job. Figma's so
shout
so
out
fun.
Figma.
Shout out Figma. We love Figma. I love Figma. So I just go on Figma and that's when you start doing UX, UI design. So you think of information architecture, all those things that we talked about, hierarchy, where things should be, what follows up after what, and map how the experience gonna be in general. And it's very intentional and you think, I don't know, the research portion of it is like you're looking at other things, you're looking at other work from other people online and going through portfolios, looking at similar experience. Like, I don't know, I go on, I make maps. I don't know if I'm doing something that somebody needs to, I don't know, call an API from, I will probably open Postman and really look at how their user experience is. And, you know, just like something that's analog, look at your neighbors, see how they are, and try to get inspiration from them. So I do that, and then the UI design, whatever library I'm using, just putting it all together and executing on those UX principles, like all the information architecture and everything, and just translating them into components that's going to become web components. So being an engineer helps with that because I know how painful it is to build those components. So I know how to use my design libraries in a way that I know what the defaults are, and it's going to make the code cleaner down the line for everyone in the end. So do all of that, navigation, desired path, all the fun parts, artistic, if you will. And then after that, we like to do a user testing. And just to clarify the problem to the users, or to validate the solution, depends on where we are. If the product's already being built, we like to do a session of that just to validate that we're going to the right direction. Or if it's before, we just want to make sure that the problems that the users have, like how is it for them to understand this? So then our design is addressing them. So we usually get, I don't know, 5 to 7 people from different areas and have them interact with prototypes in like a couple minute sessions, like a 20, 30 minute session. We bribe them with coffee and everyone goes and helps a lot with their insights. We document all of them, bring it back to the table, add to the design, iterate on that, implement all the user feedback. And then we do, when we're locked in a design that we're confident that is tested and approved by our users and we're addressing all the main concerns in performing what the product's supposed to, we lock it in and we do a design handoff to the engineering team so they can build up against that you have designed. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It does.
Yeah, and then there's like just a couple of things in the end. Like once the thing is in motion, if there are some points of confusion or we uncover any new use cases, just because like you learn about feasibility of things when you're building it. Or sometimes if it's a longer tailed project, something's changed and you need to readjust. So we are always in touch with smaller design iterations while the software is being built. We can do another testing to validate the direction too, especially if there's any compromises or if the software is going to any different direction. But then in the end, we do one big pass of a design review, make sure everything behaves as we designed, and ship the product.
Nice, I like it. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So to maybe quickly summarize, would you say like step one, you're collaborating with the product manager SME who owns it, then you're step two, translating those requirements into like Figma or just designs. Step three, you're like, okay, cool, here's what it looks like. You run it by real people and you do dry runs where you're like, okay, what would you click on? What would you do next? What's confusing? Yeah, I've sat in on some of those and I found they're super helpful. So next step, you're like, cool, we tested it. We've locked in the design. Hey, like engineers, start building. Then as they're building, you periodically do feedback and evaluation. Sometimes you adjust things. And then finally, there's like a final design review. And then you're like, cool, we're all happy. Obviously, there's probably iteration and like future stuff. That's probably just the V0. But yeah, that process makes a lot of sense to me. Keep going.
Oh, no worries. Go for it.
I was just going to move on. So, but if you have anything about this, you're welcome to share.
Oh, yeah. No, just about the design handoff, which is something that I'm learning a lot about. And we have evolving technology around that, which is very, very fun. Like Figma right now is a really cool tool. And you can prototype things so in detail that really does help your developers. But it's very important that the design is very comprehensive, just because not necessarily the people that will be building it know where you're coming from. And I mean that by like, how do things behave? Like how are hover states for things? How, like, should we confirm every single deletion? So like getting granular for your design, like thinking of the fine grain iterations, it's like, it goes a long way for developing it later.
I like that. Yeah, that makes sense. So to start wrapping up, I was curious if you had any common mistakes or general advice you wanted to leave people with, given, you know, your experience doing this.
Educate people from the get-go. Get people involved in security from day one and establish those patterns, those ways of thinking as soon as you can. At Netflix, we do that when we are onboarding people. We introduce them to the $100 word here, paved road. We introduce them to the paved road when they're just joining the company. And we really tell them, like, this is how we think about encryption. This is how we do, I don't know, logins. This is how we do this thing. So introduce them to those building blocks and your company way of doing these things from onboarding. And then when the first app that they do already follows all of this, I think something that we do on Netflix, we do a test project. So as soon as you join, you do a project applying every single one of these things just so you can learn how to build security software in your test project. And we go as far as teaching them how to delete it. So everyone as an engineer has built at least one secure app for sure on their first week during onboarding. That's like, yeah, my main advice: start from the beginning, set precedents and make your defaults secure. And another one too is to just think that, like, have that in mind that you care about risk and security, people don't. So it's really important that you make it usable for them, not for you, for them. And they just build up connections from there and meet people where they are, talk in a language that they understand. So don't be like me talking about auto right sizing. Like, just say what you mean. Like, don't share this with too many people. Just use words that like resonate with people, that they get it, instead of security jargon. And remove away any complexity you can and use patterns that are, I don't know, ingrained in our minds, like traffic and billboards and commercials. I don't know.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And that's a really great point with regards to onboarding. That's such a nice touch point that, you know, everyone goes through. So having them use all the paved road things start to finish their first week. Yeah, that sounds very clever. So yeah, Letty, it's been a pleasure. Is there any like final things you'd like to share? I don't know, words of wisdom, advice, rants, really, whatever you want to before we end?
That you don't need to be very out of the normal interested person in usability to care about it. You don't need to have usability in your kitchen like I do and have your cups near your fridge because it's just easier to get water. You don't need to be a nerd in none of this to just abstract away complexity of your things. Like, really just talk about it as if you were talking to somebody who doesn't get it, and but with the intention of making them understand, use analogies compared to other things, use different language, and just be creative. And I don't know, iterate often, collect user feedback, which is really weird to say because that's such a basic, collect user feedback. Listen to people, look at your Slack threads. Do people hate everything? Do they ask too much? If they're asking the same question over and over, your process is wrong, it's not them. So give users the time of the day.
I totally agree. Well, Letty, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time. Everyone who's watching, thanks so much for your time as well. If you liked this episode of the Modern Security Podcast, feel free to, I don't know, subscribe or like or whatever people do on whatever platform you're watching. We're going to do a number more of these. And I also run a security newsletter called TLDRSec. So if you like the latest tools, blog posts, and talks right in your inbox every week across many areas of security, from AppSec, WebSec, container security, cloud, and many others, feel free to check that out too. But have a wonderful rest of your day and talk soon. Okay.
Bye. Bye.